Support for WPR comes from UW-Superior Center for Continuing Education, offering Conversations on Living Alone, a three-part series beginning Wednesday, April 17th via Zoom. Details at uwsuper.edu.
Support for WPR comes from Stone Harbor, a Door County resort and conference center overlooking the historic Steel Bridge in Sturgeon Bay. Details about hosting a wedding or conference are at stoneharbor-resort.com.
It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Recent climate change modeling by the U.S. Forest Service showed that by the end of the century, the Acadian flycatcher could become quasi-extinct if temperatures continue to rise. We check in with researchers about this new study, plus consider what climate change means for habitats and animals in the Midwest. Wondering, birders, if you've noticed changes that researchers say may be pegged to climate change in the birds that you watch. Have you seen habitat change where you live over time? Tell us about what you've seen, and what are you doing to support preservation tactics for songbirds and other birds in your area? Maybe you're a citizen scientist. If so, what do you do to help study birds in the state and the Midwest? And what questions do you have about the state of our habitats and birds? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, and you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. I have two guests with me this morning. Ben Zuckerberg is an associate professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. His research is focused on modern climate change and habitat loss. Welcome, Benjamin.
Thank you for having me.
And Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a Senior Fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Thanks for being with us, Stan.
Good to be here.
Ben, we'll start with you. As we consider this information about the study, first, tell us about the Acadian flycatcher. Where do they live in Wisconsin?
Yeah, Acadian flycatchers are kind of a small songbird. They're mostly associated with woodlands and deciduous woodlands, so forests with lots of maples and oaks. They're actually somewhat of an uncommon sort of breeder in Wisconsin. They're definitely sort of in the more the lower half of the state. They are a migrant, so they spend most of their summers breeding sort of in southern Wisconsin, and most of their range is in more the middle and sort of southern, southeastern part of the United States, and then they overwinter in Central and South America. They do, as the name implies, sort of primarily feed on insects. They'll kind of hang out on a branch and then sort of flitter out and grab an insect on the wing, and then they'll come back and consume it. And they're also, within these woodlands, also tend to be more common in areas that are wetter, like ravines and streams.
And what do they look like?
They're kind of somewhat of a olive, greenish olive head. They have sort of these underparts with sort of a narrow, pale yellow eye ring. They also have these kind of neat little buffy sort of wing bars that are pretty distinctive as well.
Stan, is the Acadian flycatcher at risk of going extinct? What's its status?
Well, actually, throughout its range, which covers most of the eastern deciduous forest, so essentially most of the forested area east of the Mississippi, the bird is doing fairly well. The study that you referred to is looking at the status of the bird in a fairly specific part of its broader geographic range, which is across the Ozarks, southern Illinois, Missouri, Kentucky, in that sort of area. It was an area where they had a lot of existing data that they could use both on the bird as well as on habitat and climate so that they could build this fairly sophisticated model. Here in Wisconsin, you know, as Ben said, we're right at the sort of northwest fringes of the species range. And as a result, the bird is not as common here as it is further to the south and to the east. And you might expect, under some period of prolonged stress, as the bird might retrench from the periphery of its range, that places like southern Wisconsin might be the first places that you really start to see dramatic changes in the abundance of Acadian flycatchers.
The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources lists this bird as threatened. What does that mean?
Well, it means it's a bird that they are concerned about. And at least for the Acadian flycatcher in Wisconsin, the long-term population trend that goes all the way back to 1966, when the North American Breeding Bird Survey started tracking the abundance of birds, suggests that the Acadian flycatcher has already for quite a while been in a rather slow downward trend, declining at a rate of 1 or 2% a year.
We're talking about the relationship between climate change and changes in habitat and how it affects the animals within that habitat. For the moment, we're kind of focused on a single species of bird, the Acadian flycatcher, but throughout the discussion, we'll expand what we're talking about. And wondering what you're seeing as you spend time out in the woods looking for birds, for example, or just observing in your area, just what is it you're seeing? What are the changes you're seeing? And what questions do you have for our guest? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. The U.S. Forest Service recently published a study looking at the threat climate change posed to Acadian flycatchers. The study found that the species could go quasi-extinct by the end of the century if temperatures rise. But, Ben, this would happen only if we sit on our hands and do nothing, right?
Right. This is sort of the business-as-usual scenario. So if we don't do anything in terms of mitigating sort of the effects of fossil fuels or the rise of fossil fuels and climate change, then this is what the model projects out for the next 100 years. And the way these models tend to work is they take a lot of really good information on the nesting success, in this case, of Acadian flycatchers, and be able to sort of align that with sort of contemporary what we're seeing now in terms of climate, and then project that climate into the future and make projections about the productivity, the nest success of Acadian flycatchers. And what they show as part of this study is that as temperatures increase, and they're expecting these temperatures to increase pretty significantly throughout much of their the Acadian flycatcher range, that overall the productivity of Acadian flycatchers, the ability to produce lots of young, is going to decline pretty much chronically throughout the next 100 years, so much so that their populations are going to have a tough time persisting.
And what does quasi-extinct mean?
Yeah, so the idea here is not that necessarily that suddenly flycatchers will be completely gone off the face of the earth. You can't find them anywhere. The idea with a quasi-extinction level is that they'll have trouble finding mates, they'll have trouble reproducing, and so they'll be much more likely, much more threatened, much more sensitive to, let's say, an extreme event that comes through. And so the population's teetering on this edge. Again, so it doesn't necessarily mean that you won't be able to find a flycatcher in the woods anymore, but the chances of them sort of being more sensitive to a disturbance are heightened. And so that's the idea between about a quasi-extinction level, is that the population levels get so low that they have trouble reproducing and persisting.
And these are kind of technical terms, so it's important to clarify them. How is quasi-extinct different from a species being endangered?
I think that's actually part of the what we use to actually list them as endangered. So again, for an endangered, it'd have to happen across their entire range. And as Stan was mentioning, this is focused on one area of their range. What I think is interesting about the study, though, is that it's looking at these different scenarios of climate change. So the business as usual is kind of the worst case scenario where we really don't do anything in terms of mitigation or adaptation. And then the other scenarios they use are, okay, what if we actually start doing something in terms of mitigation? And what they do show is that under some of those more favorable scenarios where climate change may not be as severe, that maybe we're seeing a 1 to 2 degree warming overall, that's Celsius, into the future, that best case scenario, a lot of these populations will be able to actually persist and not go down to those sort of levels that we're most concerned about.
The U.S. Forest Service study focused on the flycatcher in particular. Stan, what is it about this bird that makes it such a good study subject? Are they like a bellwether, the canary in the coal mine, for how climate change could affect similar types of birds or even birds in general?
Well, the Acadian flycatcher is sort of an interesting case because I'm imagining that not many of your listeners have actually even heard of an Acadian flycatcher. But it is a bird that has a large geographic range throughout the eastern half of the United States. It's a bird that has historically within that range been fairly stable. And fortunately for this study, it's a bird that was very well studied throughout the region in which the researchers were making their predictions. So the interesting thing about the Acadian flycatcher is that it doesn't really, at first blush, seem to be the type of bird that would decline in the face of climate change.
And we have to pause for news. Stan, we'll come back to that point when we return. We're checking in with researchers Ben Zuckerberg and Stan Temple about the results of a new U.S. Forest Service study on the effects of climate change on habitat and wildlife. Our conversation continues in a moment. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The news is next. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're discussing the results of a new U.S. Forest Service study of the effects of climate change on habitat and the animals that live in it. What questions or comments do you have about the state of our habitat and birds? Share them with us at 800-642-1234, email ideas@wpr.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guests are Ben Zuckerberg, Associate Professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Stan, just before the news break, we were talking about whether or not the flycatcher that we've been discussing earlier was sort of a bellwether or the canary in the coal mine for how climate change could affect similar types of birds or even birds in general. Why don't we conclude that thought, and then we've got a caller that wants to join us with a question.
Sure. Well, here's the unique thing, perhaps, about the Acadian flycatcher that made it interesting for these researchers to study, and that is that it is a species that had historically been doing fairly well, and as a result, there was lots of historical data about flycatcher nesting. They had thousands of nest records. And those researchers who'd collected those data historically were not interested in climate change. But because the data was available, the current researchers were able to go back and relate the breeding success of Acadian flycatchers to what the temperature happened to be during the breeding season in a particular year. So they established a relationship between temperature during the breeding season and how well Acadian flycatchers reproduced. Now, this type of study could probably be done for many other species, and I would say that this study is an eye-opener for researchers saying, boy, it might be worth going back and looking at the historical data to see how many bird species have this relationship between temperature during the breeding season and how well they reproduce.
Forgot to turn my mic back on. Ben, why would rising temperatures lead to a general decline in birds?
Yeah, so if we can continue with the flycatcher example, part of what they think is going on there is as you get rising temperatures, a lot of the predators, especially of the bird's nest, start becoming a little bit more active. So in this case, one of the concerns that they have is that with rising temperatures and as sort of the daily temperatures increase, nest predators like snakes tend to be a little bit more active, and because of that increased activity, they are more likely to find a bird's nest, take their young, or take the eggs. And so one of the things that we're concerned about primarily, and not just for flycatchers, but for other bird species as well, is what we refer to as this indirect effect. that as temperatures are increasing, it's not necessarily just the direct effect of temperatures on these birds in terms of their ability to raise young, but the increasing temperatures is influencing predators of those nests, and that is really what's causing the populations of these birds to decline.
How big a change in temperature do we need to really feel the effects?
I think it's hard to say. In this case, what they've sort of projected out is that in 100 years, it's going to be about 25% warmer, at least in sort of the central hardwoods area of the United States that they are focusing on. What that generally means is actually an increase of about 70 degrees Celsius or so in terms of that summer temperature effect. And so in that case, that worst-case scenario could have a pretty strong effect on sort of the breeding success of these birds. That being said, in those sort of the better-case scenarios where suddenly we can sort of decrease the overall future climate change, we're talking about anywhere from a warming of maybe even less than 4 to 5% into the future temperatures.
Let's take a phone call. We'll go first to Kenneth, who's joining us from Janesville. Kenneth, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. I wonder, doesn't the temperature change the sexual ratio of the birds being hatched?
Well, I can take that one, I think. You're probably thinking of some of the studies that show that sex ratios for reptiles change with the ambient temperature in which the eggs are developing. Remember, reptiles don't incubate their eggs. They lay them, you know, in the soil, and they are exposed to the ambient temperature. Birds, on the other hand, incubate their eggs. So the temperature of the developing embryos in the eggs are essentially determined by the parent bird, not by the ambient temperature per se. So you're absolutely right. For things like reptiles, they have noted that as temperatures rise, there can be a shift in the sex ratio in the developing embryos in the eggs. But that effect has not been observed in birds.
Kenneth, thank you for that question. And your question could be next, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We referenced changes in climate that could impact the predators in this specific bird species, and that would directly impact the species. What about changes in the in the habitat itself, and this isn't directly related to this bird, but several years ago, foresters in the Schwamigan-Nicolet Forest were noting that certain species of trees were disappearing, and it was believed it was too warm for certain species, and they were basically just fading away to the north as it as our Wisconsin climate got warmer and warmer. When this type of thing happens, how does that affect the birds and other animals that might use that type of plant life for nesting or for other purposes? Stan, why don't we start with you, and then I want to hear Ben on this as well.
Sure. Well, this is well documented that as the climate warms, that certain types of habitats will move, largely because of the tolerance of the dominant plant species to temperature. And here in Wisconsin, we're in a really critical situation. If you think ecologically about Wisconsin's position, we are at the edge of the three major ecosystems of North America. We're at the western edge of the deciduous forest, we're at the eastern edge of the prairies, and we're at the southern boundaries of the northern Canadian forest. And that study that you mentioned in northern Wisconsin, of course, was looking at the forest vegetation that's primarily associated with the northern Canadian forest. And as things warm, that forest is going to shift northward, and along with it will be many species of animals that are associated with that specific habitat. The animals are essentially going to track the habitat as reflected in the vegetation.
Ben, do you want to comment on this as well?
Yeah, I think that's a great comment. And what Sam's pointing out, too, is that especially what we're concerned about are these sort of species in northern Wisconsin that are most associated with forests that you expect to be coming down, forest types that are more common in Canada. And these are more sort of cold-adapted species, northerly adapted species that are actually meeting their sort of southern range limit sort of right in the middle of Wisconsin. And these species are like rough grouse and spruce grouse and other species that tend to be more northerly distributed species. These are a lot of the birds that we're most concerned about because these could be species that will be sort of shifting northward over time as the climate warms and as their habitat is lost as well.
Stan, so would other species be at risk in the same way that the Acadian flycatcher is?
Yeah, we definitely are concerned about that, and as you kind of mentioned, we're thinking about trying to identify those species that are most vulnerable. What are those sort of sentinels of climate change out there? And another group of species that we think actually works in a very similar way are grassland birds. We've done our own research and using similar population models that they do for the Acadian flycatchers for henslow sparrows. And this is a grassland bird that is very sensitive to changes in precipitation. So it's not necessarily just temperature when we think about climate change. We're also worried about changes in precipitation like drought. And so one of the main implications and findings that we've seen is that, yeah, definitely this is another species that could be very sensitive to changes in rainfall, and that change in rainfall could actually lead to changes in overall nest success and contraction of range, the sort of the loss of these populations in many areas. So for species like grassland birds, which are really widely declining throughout much of their range, and even here in Wisconsin, that's a group of species that we're particularly concerned about being impacted by sort of warming temperatures and sort of the changing rainfall patterns.
And Stan, I presume that the fact that we're kind of on the border of three major kinds of ecosystems is one of the reasons that the Midwest is such a good place to monitor the effects of climate change on birds and other species.
Well, that's exactly right. And of course, there's the other side of this equation, too, and that is that as the climate changes and Wisconsin's climate is going to essentially warm as we move northward, what we're going to see is not only birds in the northern part of the state moving northward and out of Wisconsin, but we're also going to see southern birds that are going to be moving into Wisconsin as it gets warmer. And a couple of these that are already sort of at our doorstep and starting to appear, they actually have names that imply where they're normally found. So Carolina wrens and Carolina chickadees and Kentucky warblers are all species that are primarily found south of Wisconsin, but as the climate warms, they will be moving into Wisconsin. So there's a parade of species that are moving out of Wisconsin and moving into Wisconsin as a result of climate change.
Ben, a moment ago you mentioned grassland and temperature and rainfall changes and what they mean for grassland birds. Can you quickly define what a grassland bird is?
Sure, yeah. Grassland birds are a group of species, and these are species that, in fact, a lot of your listeners may run into if they're out in sort of open areas. These are species like bobolinks and eastern meadowlarks, savanna sparrows. This is a group of species that we've been really worried about in terms of conservation, primarily because we've seen the loss of a lot of grassland habitats due to agriculture and due to sort of increasing suburban development. And so you can think about prairie systems as being these areas that a lot of these grassland birds are most dependent on. And many of these birds have shown very strong population declines really throughout the United States over the last 30 years. And in terms of climate change, you can imagine that a prairie system, a grassland, an open area is very exposed to changes in temperature and changes in rainfall. And so what we're really concerned about is how does sort of future climate change going to impact what is already a group of species that has been declining for a very long time.
800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, the number to call to join our program. If you have a comment or a question for our guests, Ben Zuckerberg and Stan Temple, we're talking about the results of a recent U.S. Forest Service study on the effects of climate change on certain species of birds and their habitat and what that ultimately means. 800-642-1234. There are birds that have adapted to the cold of Wisconsin winters, like the ruffed grouse, and we mentioned those a bit earlier. Ben, how have the ruffed grouse been affected by warming temperatures?
Yeah, the story with ruffed grouse that we're also concerned about is that there are a number of these cold-adapted species that they're non-migratory, so they're not doing what a lot of other birds do, which is they don't migrate down to Central and South America. They kind of stick it out through the winter. And one of the main implications of a warming winter and a warming temperatures throughout the upper Midwest is that you're seeing a decline in snow cover and snow cover duration and snow cover depth. And this is something we've been able to document really well. So grouse are a type of bird that actually really do use that snow cover. They'll do something called snow roosting. They'll kind of fly up into the air, and then they'll dive bomb underneath sort of the snow layer. And that's really important for them to kind of get through the winter, because underneath that sort of nice blanket of snow, they'll be less exposed to cold temperatures and they'll be less exposed to predators. And so as you get sort of the loss of this snow cover throughout the upper Midwest and Wisconsin, especially in parts of southern Wisconsin and central Wisconsin, what we're wondering about and concerned about is whether or not that loss of snow cover could actually expose more grouse to predation and expose them more to sort of bad weather during the winter. And what we've been able to actually look at is their stress levels. And sure enough, what we see is that grouse that are exposed to sort of colder temperatures generally have increased stress levels. But they can actually avoid that sort of temperature and avoid that stress level by sort of getting underneath the snow and snow roosting. And the implications of that is that if you've got birds that are really stressed out, that over time it could affect, again, their reproduction and their nest success and lead to these population declines.
We have a caller who wants to join us from Lake Mills. Bruce is with us. Bruce, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Morning. I was wondering about getting back to the flycatchers and possible predation of the reptiles. What about the turkey influence on keeping the reptiles down? We have massive amounts of turkeys here.
Well, maybe I'll try that one. Yeah. Actually, again, referring to where this particular study that we're talking about took place, it's quite a ways south of Wisconsin. So it's down in the Ozarks and sort of through the Ohio Valley, where they have a lot more snakes that are predators on bird nests. Here in Wisconsin, snakes are not a principal problem for birds. Because we're further north, reptiles don't do as well. And in fact, most of the types of snakes that might threaten a bird like the Acadian flycatcher are themselves in pretty deep trouble in Wisconsin. A lot of them are threatened species and declining. But you're absolutely right. If you care about reptiles in Wisconsin, they are also, of course, going to be affected not only by climate change, but by many of the other changes that are taking place in the environment. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens to some of these reptile populations, whether they, like birds, are going to be able to shift their geographic ranges to sort of keep track of the climate. Remember, birds can fly, so they can move and extend their ranges pretty quickly. If you're a reptile, you can't move very quickly, and the question is, can they keep pace with the rate at which the climate is changing?
Speaking for myself, I'm glad reptiles can't fly. That I think that's a big plus. 800-642-1234, come and join our discussion of this U.S. Forest Service study on the effects of climate change on the habitat and the animals living in it. Ben Zuckerberg and Stan Temple are with me for about another 20 minutes. We're going to check the news and come right back. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Climate change is having an impact on wildlife habitat and on wildlife itself. We're talking about the conclusions of a U.S. Forest Service study on the subject. What do you think about all this? Let us know. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guests are Ben Zuckerberg, Associate Professor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. We have a lot of phone calls people have questions and comments. Let's get right to them. We'll start in Green Bay, where David joins us this morning. David, welcome to the morning show. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good morning. I was wanted to comment that we actually have one of these flycatchers that have been nesting in our yard for quite a few years, probably 6-7 years. They've been coming back every year, and they're really interesting to watch. And had a couple of questions. One was, what is their migration route? Where do they end up in their southern range? And then another kind of unrelated to the flycatcher, but I was curious if your guest had any ideas on the population decline of the whippoorwills, because we used to have, I bet you, a dozen of them in our area, and over the last couple of years, we don't have any anymore. So curious on that one as well.
David, thanks for your question. Well, who wants to tackle this? Ben, Stan?
I can take the winter range question. They generally extend sort of from the Caribbean slope of Nicaragua through Costa Rica, Panama, Colombia, I think Western Ecuador. And actually, it's kind of interesting to note that in their wintering habitat, they generally actually prefer kind of more shrubby kind of as opposed to sort of the forest that I think we generally associate with them. So they can definitely still be in forest in their wintering areas, but they'll also kind of take advantage of more shrubby habitat as well. So definitely Central and South America.
And Stan, you want to talk about the decline of the whippoorwill? I was going to ask about that too, so I'm really glad David called in this morning.
Yeah, I can certainly address that. I have whippoorwills in my backyard in Mazamania, Wisconsin, and have actually monitored the population there for the last 40 years. And as elsewhere in Wisconsin, and indeed throughout the entire range of the whippoorwill, their numbers are declining. There are several things going on. Some are local here to the breeding range, and others are more global. Here on the breeding range in the upper Midwest and in Wisconsin, a change in the type of forest that whippoorwills like to nest in is making the habitat less suitable for them. In my area, sort of an interesting problem is that whippoorwills used to be associated with woodlots that dairy farmers grazed, because it kept the understory very open. And as the cows have gotten out of the woods and into the barn, the understory of a lot of the woodlots in southern and central Wisconsin have become overgrown with shrubs that whippoorwills don't like. The other thing is their food supply. Some of the insects that they most favor have declined, especially some of the larger moths, night flying moths. And to make things worse for whippoorwills, there are problems on their wintering range as well. So we have a problem of deterioration of habitat on the breeding range. They're probably not nesting as successfully. And we have problems with them not surviving the winter as well because of problems on the winter range.
David, thanks so much for that question. Let's go next to Randy in Ripon. Gosh, I love alliteration. Randy, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Well, good morning. You just answered one of my observations with the whippoorwills, because I haven't heard of one in, I think, it's decades. I live up here by Ripon, central part of the state, and when we used to go camping over in campgrounds to the west here, Wetoma and so forth, and it's been years since I've heard one. My other observation was, as a kid growing up, I used to hear meadowlarks and see red-headed woodpeckers, and you know, I haven't, and I know the farming practices have changed commonly. The south of Ripon, they call it the prairie, and there used to be or roads you see tree lined, fence rows, and there you see patch. That's all been wiped clean. Woodlots are just being bulldozed into piles and burnt. I mean, I just amazes, astounds me how it's just. I don't know how birds migrate that desert coming north because there's nothing there for them. It just astounds me. And that's my concern is the loss of habitat for all these and just places to rest or even to nest. It's like these little islands now of cities and urban areas that all left. But I'm also grateful that we have cranes and pelicans and eagles that were never around when I was a kid, including turkeys, too. It's kind of a strange. We've got abundance of these critters now, but not, you know, loss of the other ones.
Randy, thanks for your call. Stan, what about we're kind of shifting toward different bird species being more populous? And talk a little bit more about how changes in farming practices have affected habitat overall.
Sure. Well, the very species, of course, that have recovered so spectacularly in Wisconsin have largely recovered because of our conservation efforts. So things like turkeys that were almost, well, essentially wiped out in Wisconsin by overhunting in the late 19th century have recovered remarkably with modern wildlife management. Things like bald eagles that were affected by DDT and other agricultural chemicals have recovered once we recognized that problem and solved it. So there's a hopeful sign there that when we recognize a problem and address it, that some of these bird species will respond. The issue of habitat and agriculture is a long-standing one. Agriculture, of course, changes the habitat dramatically, and it means that there are many species of wildlife that end up being losers, you might say, when their habitat is converted to agriculture. Today, one of the big issues for grassland birds is the fact that there are no really large areas of prairie left in the Midwest, so most of these grassland birds are nesting in agricultural grasslands, often in hay fields and pastures, and how farmers manage those pastures and hay fields has a lot to do with how well the birds will do there. Mowing early for hay destroys nests. The type of grazing practices that farmers use on their pastures can also affect nest success. So grassland birds, at least in Wisconsin and throughout the upper Midwest, are very dependent on how farmers manage the habitat on the farm.
We're coming to the end of the hour, and I really would like to get to some ideas for what we might do going forward. Stan, is there anything that can be done to help Midwestern bird species, short of reversing climate change?
Well, obviously reversing climate change is one big thing that we could do that would have benefits far beyond just Wisconsin birds. But one of the other things to recognize is that although climate change is this perversive threat, each species of bird will be facing other types of threats, whether it's habitat loss, whether it's invasions of their habitat by invasive species. In some cases, we are still responsible for causing excessive mortality. All of those things can be addressed once the problem is identified. And I think one of the big benefits of the study that we've been discussing is that it has revealed something that we were only vaguely aware of, and that is that the nesting success for many birds may be dependent on temperature. In the same way that if you go back 75 years ago, we were struggling to figure out why some birds weren't reproducing well, only to discover that it was DDT in the food chain. And that, of course, opened up a whole line of conservation actions. So some of the things we're discovering about temperature and the breeding success of birds will probably lead to some conservation practices. There are things you can do to benefit these birds to sort of mitigate and offset the effects of climate change. For the Acadian flycatcher that we've been discussing, they have the highest nest success rate in large patches of forest. So increasing the size of forest patches might be one way that we could help them improve their nesting success, even in the face of the impact, the negative impacts of climate change.
What can the average citizen do to help with this? Ben, can you think of a couple of suggestions here as we get to the close?
I think supporting conservation efforts in your own backyard. Trying to think about what you do in your own life that can reduce your overall carbon footprint. Maybe it's carpooling, maybe it's getting energy efficient appliances, and I think supporting local and county initiatives that are focusing on climate change adaptation and mitigation. And there's a lot of work being done at that, the local level, that people can support. And I think most importantly, keeping the conversation going, talking with your neighbors, talking with your family about climate change, about the things that you're seeing, keeping that conversation open and continuing and that dialogue evolving is something that I think is really important for the success of future conservation.
And do you think it's realistic to expect that these individuals will make these changes and that it'll really happen? Stan, you first, and then we'll give Ben the last word.
It's only at the individual level, I think, that you're going to get the momentum going that's going to change some of these trends that are harming wildlife. So, yes, absolutely. We can't just sit back and depend on government and conservation organizations. For them to take action often requires that individuals put some pressure on them to move. Fortunately, birds have a pretty big support network out there. So when birds get into trouble, it often generates the type of citizen engagement that leads to conservation action.
Ben, I'll give you the last 15 seconds for a final thought here.
Go out and become a citizen scientist. We need people involved in collecting data. Without data, we would have nothing to do as scientists. So there are a lot of great programs out there, like the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, Project Feeder Watch, eBird. These are programs that allow citizens and allow the communities and allow people to go out there and collect data on the ground about where birds are. We need those data.
All right. We've got our marching orders. Ben Zuckerberg and Stan Temple, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Ben Zuckerberg, Associate Professor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Stan Temple, Professor Emeritus of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.